You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The English Stories is the latest book by Vancouver author Cynthia Flood. It's a set of linked short stories set in England in the 1950s. Cynthia Flood's stories have won numerous awards, including the Journey Prize and a National Magazine Award, and in 2002, her novel, Making a Stone of the Heart, was nominated for the City of Vancouver Book Prize. Cynthia Flood joins me in the studio this morning to talk about the English stories and to read from the book. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi, Jane.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Now, the main character in the book is Amanda. Tell us about her.
Well, she's 11 when she goes to school in England and really has no idea what this is going to be like. She's quite a private person. She's quite critical, a bit prickly in her way of relating to the outside world. And she is imaginative, but in sort of little bursts. There's a lot about her that's really quite a conformist, desiring of being in conformity with other people, and she's obsessed with words, or fascinated by words, I guess is a fairer way of putting it.
And she's in England, she's Canadian, and she's
in
England.
She's in Canadian, and she's there because her father and mother have gone to England for 1 year that turns out to be two. Her father's doing research on a book about the Romantic poets, and her mother is obviously there, and because of the need for her father to travel about, they don't set up housekeeping. They live in a residential hotel in Oxford, and Amanda goes to school there, sometimes boarding and sometimes as a daycare, depending on whether her parents are in town or not.
So the two locations of the stories then are this residential hotel.
Mm-hmm. And the school.
And the school. Tell us a little bit about the school. What kind of school
is
it?
Well, the school was, I think, probably a very standard kind of private Anglican girls' school of that era. It wasn't smart. It wasn't fancy. It's quite shabby. There's one story by the headmistress, Miss Pringle, in her voice, which makes it clear exactly how shabby that place was. This is 6 years after the end of the Second World War. There's, of course, the uniform, and there's the usual, you know, games of hockey and lacrosse and all that stuff. And it's a number of older teachers or mistresses who've been kind of through the war and knew Britain at an earlier period, and a number who were younger and have kind of different visions, I think, of what the school is like. So it's a closed community, like all schools. It's about half and half boarders and day girls. And there's kind of a bit of a class system between those two groups also. And the residential hotel, I mean, when I was in England at that period, we lived in this place. I didn't see anything odd about it, but the further away it got from it, the odder it seemed, and the stranger seemed the people who lived there. I mean, I can't imagine anybody would say in youth, I would like to end my days in essentially a small boarding house, sitting in a dining room with people who are also have nowhere else to go or be, in very sort of borderline genteel poverty, eating terrible food and mending your clothes and going out for little walks around the block or bird watching or whatever. But there were some very interesting and some highly educated, some not, and some very creative and eccentric people there. And it wasn't until much later when I began to write this series of stories, which I didn't at first realize was going to be a series, that I began actually looking at these people and thinking, good Lord, how did they get there? What is the background? How did they arrive?
Well, we should make it clear at this point that this isn't an autobiographical
book. No, in that
book.
Sense, it's not. I mean, I did go to England in those years. I did go to boarding school, though not in Oxford. My parents did set up in a residential hotel there. But very few of the events that are in the stories are as they occurred. The ambience, the emotions, the social interactions, the class system, the attitudes to religion, attitudes to sexuality, experience of relationships between adults and children, those are kind of as close to actual as I could get them.
What interests you about the time and the place of the stories?
Well, perhaps it was not understood then, though I think perhaps some people understood that at that point Britain was done for as a world power. But I think a lot of British people did not realize that, and it took a while, for, as you might say, for that to sink in, maybe even 15 years before that had completely sunk. And as somebody said, it had to do with the Beatles, I think, that the empire sank giggling into the sunset or something like that. But it really wasn't understood at that point. There was a lot of very strong pro-empire feeling, very strong pro-Army, Air Force, Navy feeling, great feelings of loyalty to Britain, etc., and so on. They were very strong, and not only in Britain, all around the world, in what was still the empire, but now called the Commonwealth, that was all still very strong. And looking back, it's so clear that the thing was collapsing. It was absolutely collapsing, and a lot of the people in the story, in fact, are in the stories, are sort of emblematic of that collapse. They are not going to live out the ends of their lives in the same country they grew up in. It's going to change around them incredibly in the next 10 years or so. And they will feel themselves probably, I think, quite foreign in their own land by the time they come to the end.
So it's that on the cusp of this huge change that kind of grabs you after all these years.
Yeah? And it is. And I think also the ages of 11 and 12, I mean, I think those are really important years in childhood, because you are old enough to be able to observe, to have some of your own ideas, to have read something, talk to people, etc. But you're not yet overcome by the tumult of adolescent sexuality and hormones. You kind of are a very, very, very young, small adult in a way, intellectually anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amanda is in most of the stories, but they're not all told from her point of view. Why did you decide to mix it up like that?
Well, I think I decided to do that because the first three stories I wrote certainly were centered on Amanda. The first one is the one called Country Life, in which she goes to visit a very interesting spinster in the English countryside. And I wrote that one without any thought there would ever be any more. But then within the next couple of years, I had written the one called Magnificat and the one called Early in the Morning. And those are both quite intensively in Amanda's viewpoint, even though they're not necessarily told in first person. And it became apparent that that wasn't enough, that there was more that I wanted to show or say about Britain at that time than could possibly even be seen by a smart, perceptive 11-year-old. There had to be other voices, there had to be other angles, and that's why the other people came in.
What's the appeal for you as a writer of doing a set of linked short stories? Not the individual ones, but not the novel, but that kind of maybe a hybrid form?
Well, it is, I think, kind of a hybrid form, and I have to say I enjoyed doing it a lot. I mean, I love writing short stories. It's very satisfying to work on one of those and come to the point where you think, yes, that is done. That's 15, 18, 12 pages or whatever, and I have got there that little world that I wanted to create. But it's kind of like opening a window to think, well, okay, well, we could have another one that would just, you know, show another part of that circumstance. And, I mean, it is, novelists do this. I mean, you think of Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. I mean, that was four novels retelling the same story, four different people. So this is not nearly as formally organized than that. It's quite diverse. There's several different narrators and different narrative points of view even within those. But it's pleasant to do that, but it's to have that variety, but it's also not like being trapped in the middle of a great big novel. And in the novels I have written, one of which is published, one not yet, I have certainly felt that, like you're in the middle of the woods and you can't see any sunlight anywhere and you wonder, how am I ever going to get out of this thing? And you don't feel that with a group of stories. I mean, you may feel for a while, I'm not quite satisfied with this one, but I can go and work on the other one. And maybe while I do that, I'll get an idea, come back to this one and see how it needs to end or what that little scene needs to do. So it has, in a way, it has the advantages of both.
You're touching on something there that something I just recently learned. I can't remember if I heard it on the radio or read it in a book, and somebody said, it's so difficult to be a writer.
Well, it is difficult to be a writer. Having said that, it's probably one of the most satisfying things I do and always have done. And in some ways, when I am in the middle of writing a story, not necessarily a story, but something else, and when I'm really fully immersed in that, I can't think of any way in which I could be more fully myself or happier. Which is not to say that there aren't other things in my life that can make me very happy too, because there are. But there is that sensation of doing something that is kind of yours. That is what you do and what you are, and you're in the middle of doing it. Wonderful feeling. Although difficult, yes, because then you have that wonderful feeling, and then the next day you read what you've written and you think, oh, well, that's not going to work.
Now, you've chosen a couple of passages from the book to read for us, and I'm going to ask you to read the first one now. Could you set it up for us?
Yeah, the first story in the book is called The Indian Box, and it's set in Ontario in the summer of 1951. And I should say that this is set, well, it's set in Ontario, obviously Canada, and the last story in the book is also set in Canada. So there's kind of these bookends on the English stories, where Amanda comes from, where she goes back to. And this is in cottage country in Ontario, which one of the districts of cottage country, which is Muskoka. The Indian Box, summer 1951. The Indian set up two orange crates overlaid with oilcloth near the grocery but off the sidewalk so the white people need not step aside to pass her. On display were boxes and canoes of birch bark and braided sweetgrass adorned with porcupine quills. There was also beadwork. In deerskin there were coin purses, dolls with supplicating arms and red feathered headbands, and brooches in the shapes of elephant, giraffe, camel, with safety pins for clasps. The Indian woman said nothing. Nor did Mrs. Ellis. Wasting no time, she looked, chose, paid. In the sunshine, Amanda waited for permission to run down the hill to their car for the drive back to the cottage. Was the Indian woman herself a mother? Where did she exist, when not with ice-cream-licking tourists, matrons laden with big wrapped roasts, and barefoot city children in Kapok life jackets who'd proudly paddled into town from the family island? Such questions did not occur. Amanda just waited. Here and there, in the small rooms of the Ellis cottage, birch bark boxes stood on tables and dressers. On the Queen's birthday, when the family came up to Muskoka for the first time since Thanksgiving, a rush of sweetgrass and cedar met them at the open door. Every summer, Rachel Ellis bought more boxes as souvenirs for houseguests. She wiped them with household bleach and set them in the disinfectant sun. The fragrance of sweetgrass, soon prevailing, would last for decades. Not long before the family sailed away and the Empress of Britain, Amanda got a new box of her own, round, quilled in red and white. The lid had a maple leaf. Mr. Ellis laughingly set the lid on his daughter's head. Queen of my heart! Mrs. Ellis snapped the two of them with Amanda's new brownie, but her father moved. When the prince came, he was blurry. Gerald, really, couldn't you remember to stay still? Packing for England, Amanda set pebbles from Lake Muskoka in the box and tiny lake clamshells. In went her best barrettes, three Woolworth rings, ruby, sapphire, emerald, a writing pad and envelopes, a tiny set of watercolors, her bag of jacks. The silver paper from her mother's export A's wrapped up her Canadian coins, a maple leaf, a beaver, the blue nose, a caribou, and a voyageur with a scalp-locked guide. King George VI's neat haircut backed each one.
That Indian box appears throughout the book. What does it symbolize?
Well, in a way, it symbolizes Canada for Amanda. She keeps things in it that are important to her from her life there and that come to be important to her for her life in Canada, in England. It's sometimes conceals things she doesn't want other people to find, such as her mother. Once it's an occasion of great humiliation when girls at school open it and throw its contents about. And on the voyage back from England at the end of the book, she kind of, I guess, has a moment of revulsion against her life to date. And she takes everything out of the Indian box and goes up on deck and throws everything overboard, the English and the Canadians. So she thinks that she's coming back to Canada with a clean slate and kind of starting fresh, which, of course, we can never do. But that's what she thinks she is doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it also picks up on a theme in the book, which is basically colonialism, both of England to Canada, England to Ireland, parents over children, teachers over pupils. And there's a number of parallels that are drawn throughout the book related to that. So the box is a number of different things.
Now, there is, as you say, that there's a constant theme throughout the book of a deep-seated racism against the Irish that's mm-hmm. expressed by the characters who live in mm-hmm. England. Is this simply a reflection of the time and the place of the stories?
Well, it's certainly, particular to the time and the place, but it in the situation of the British relationship to Ireland, we're looking back about 700 years of richly developed racism, and very strongly similar to the white settler behavior on arrival in North America. I mean, this assumption that people can just be, moved aside, got out of the way, get in there, plant. Be a plantation, plant the new country, plant the new culture, plant the new cities, towns, farms, forts, whatever you want to, that those people do not count. And I think that's one of the premises of colonialism. In a lot of ways, it's a very frequent premise that in the way that parents treat children, that these are unimportant, these are lesser beings who need to be molded and shaped, etc. And that's certainly a very traditional teacher attitude towards children in particular.
It's shocking in the book, and I was surprised mm-hmm. it was shocking for me because I grew up in the UK, and, mm-hmm. and that would have been all around me. Mm-hmm. I was only probably there growing up about 10 years after mm-hmm. Amanda was there. And yet it was shocking for me, and mm-hmm. I imagine it would be shocking for Canadian readers.
Well, in a way it may be, but I think there's that, you kind of are accustomed to the racism you grew up with, and there's an expression that you see every now and then. There's something referred to as casual racism or casual anti-Semitism. And I do not know who invented that phrase, but I'm sure the recipients of those attitudes don't really feel there's much that's casual about it. But certainly, I grew up in a household that was anti-Catholic, anti-American, anti-Jewish, anti-French, anti-Irish, although my father had Northern Irish background, which is probably why he was so anti-Irish. And it was all just quite comfortably taken for granted. And these are, educated, cultured people, etc., just like the Germans, who were so full of Bach and Beethoven and Goethe and Faust and all the rest of it, and turned into Nazis, just all the same thing there in little. And you see it in a child, you see it in the children, too, in the book here and there, that casual kind of contempt for people who are slightly other, slightly different, different accent, slightly different looks, etc. I mean, that Nigerian girl who is coming to the school in Miss Pringle's story, and you think, oh, what will it be like for her?
Now, the epigraph to the book is a line from The Year of the French by an Irish writer, mm-hmm. Thomas Flanagan. What's the quote?
Well, it's, let me just turn to it here. It is rather the rule than the exception in human affairs that the principal actors in great events lack all knowledge of the true causes by which they are propelled. And that's from Thomas Flanagan's novel, The Year of the French. He has a trilogy of historical novels about Ireland set mostly 18th century, sort of sliding into the 19th. And there's The Year of the French and The End of the Hunt, and I can't remember the title of the third. They're very good historical novels. And when I read that, I was at that point working on Mr. Green's story, The Civil Plantation. But the first thing I thought was, that's really true. As you get older, you look back and you see decisions you made, and the reasons for which you thought you made them, and those reasons did have their validity. But there was a whole backstory and a whole context that you did not see. And sometimes that could be as recent as like yesterday or this morning or whatever. But I think that's a really common human state. So I began by thinking about Mr. Green in the Civil Plantation story. And he's an Irishman who pretends to be English. And I think his real motivating experience or emotion is intense hatred of the English and of British imperialism. But he doesn't express it except in keeping these notes about Irish history, which he probably will never publish. Amanda's mother thinks that she's going off to England to support her husband, who's a great scholar and writer, in doing kind of a definitive work on Keats and Shelley. But he's a trifler and an idler and a waster, and he's never going to get his book done. And she's just spent all that time and effort and a completely lost cause, and she didn't know that when she sat out. Same with Miss Pringle. She thinks she's upholding kind of the ramparts of empire, and she's not. She's standing on the shore that slides away.
Let's finish with a reading from Miss Pringle.
Okay.
So this is going to be a longer section that mm-hmm. you're going to read, and this is, you want to just set it up for us?
Miss Pringle is the headmistress of the school that Amanda attends, and it's her story is told in the form of a diary that she keeps, which is partly just a kind of administrative diary of events of the school and what's happening and things she needs to remember to do, these little memos she writes to herself. But she also allows herself times when she kind of takes off and thinking about what her job entails, thinking about what she's doing, thinking about the principles involved. And her story is called Miss Pringle's Hour. There's one sort of point where she kind of feels herself at the top of her bend, as it were. But this is the introduction to the story of Miss Pringle's Hour, which also, I may say, is a love story. Fatherless girls are a particular concern. There are 14 in the school. It is a great loss, a great absence, and not all of them have sensible mothers. Of course, we mourn their soldier fathers who fell, but never think that these deaths and the terrible destruction of English cities were the sum of the war. Cut is the branch that might have grown full straight. Timorousness, a certain superficiality or frivolity, an unsuitable bravado, or an excessive conscience, in fatherless girls, these are among the fruits of war. The teaching staff must be aware of this and attempt corrective measures while the pliancy of youth still allows for change. Mem, speak to Michelson, read less criticism of Felicity's handiwork. July 8th, house tennis match, won by St. Hilda's. All the girls played very well, I thought. The tension of speech day has eased and our usual healthy attitude is with us again. Mem, commend Miss Fielding. July 10th, talk on social work as a career from Mrs. Edwards of the Jubilee Infirmary. Is it really 12 months since her last visit? She spoke well, although I wish she would refrain from jokes. Senior girls about to leave school do not need such enticements in order to pay attention. Departing, Mrs. E. commented that the girls' uniforms, quote, have such a pretty old-fashioned look. Question mark? Mem, ask R.H. Perusing the pedagogical theories of Mr. Neal at Summerhill, I recently came upon a tirade against uniforms. How little that man understands. Repeatedly, I have seen their beneficence at work. Angela, when she came to us, shy and anxious, our uniform sheltered her from notice. Thus reassured, she was able to work. Term by term, she developed confidence in herself and her school. I can see her now, attaching her first monitor's pin to her tunic. Or was that Anthea? Such care and pride. Her posture is much improved. She has reached the sixth. She leaves her sleeves rolled up after games, sets her school hat at a tilt. Within sight of her general certificate, Amelia treats her uniform casually, knowing she is nearly ready to discard it. July 20th, staff versus first sixth tennis match, won by first sixth. I am not sure that Miss Fielding was pleased with this victory, at part at least the result of her excellent coaching of the girls. She is, after all, still young herself. But July 25th, end of term. All went well with only the customary few confusions of missed trains and forgotten articles. R.H. this time required Fitzgerald to take the trunks to the dormitories 3 days in advance, not two, which made a great difference. Her attention to detail is only matched by her skill in overall planning. What would St. Mildred's do without Miss Ruth Hodgson, assistant head? H.R.H. Efficiency contributes to the school's tone, which is much changed since the days of my predecessor, a kindly woman of small authority. After tea, I began my inspection. Moss on the front steps has spread shockingly. Why Fitzgerald has not attended to this, I cannot think. Wear and tear are plain on the furniture in the junior and staff common rooms, but... As for the curtains, I chose them in 1936. The piano tuner must come. The forms, springboard, and mats in the gym are shabby but serviceable. I had thought Miss Gregson's complaint about her laboratory exaggerated, but I am compelled to admit she is right. I should not like any member of council to see the present equipment. The lower fifth's copies of the Illustrated History of Modern Britain are a disgrace, full of idle markings in pen. We cannot have this. Probably there will be no new edition for years. Not a decade since the war, and already such careless waste. The grounds look well. In this, Fitzgerald is meticulous. Re-roofing the main building was the right decision. Mem. Emphasize verticality in welcome talk in September. To council, emphasize relation between equipment, furniture, and quality education. Compare Clarendon. Speak to Fitzgerald about the steps. Muriatic acid. Gwen, re-abuse of senior common room piano. Trout, re-closer supervision of the fifth. RH to inquiry, new climbing ropes, a range tuner, cost lab equipment, fine fabric samples. Chintz, 12 de Juillet. As I stand on the steps and the girls have left and look out over the gravel drive and the great lawn, the silence fairly echoes. Miss Percival, who stayed only a term or two just after the war, once joined me at this hour and said, "Let the Irish vessel lie, emptied of its poetry." All wrong, of course. Mr. Auden spoke of a dead fellow poet, not of a busy school in England, nor do his lines rhyme, nor could most of our girls be termed poetic, yet I felt in accord with her. When full of girls, our gym is not shabby.
That's a wonderful read from a wonderful book of stories. Thank you so much for coming in, Cynthia.
Well, thank you, Jane. It has been a pleasure to be in Co-op.
Cynthia Flood's latest book is The English Stories, and it's published by Biblioasis.